the aim of this talk tonight is to introduce Aquinas' basic conception of the atonement. The way that Christ redeems the world in Catholic theology is not the matter of a single, you might say, dogmatic definition. There's a lot of argument and dispute in Catholic theology about what the redemption consists of, and in Eastern and in Western Christianity, there are diverse theories. And Aquinas himself actually holds together four or five different theories. One of the larger quotes I give you near the end, I'll point out, shows you how diverse his own views are, how many different strands of the tradition he holds together. I am going to focus on one particular view he has, which is his treatment of the, what you might call, theory of satisfactio, or of rendering a just offering to God in the face of humanity's own frailties, moral failings, which he inherits from Anselm of Canterbury in his famous book, Cur Deus Homo, Why God Became Human, and which Aquinas develops in his own creative way. So let me state a couple of the basic presuppositions, what I'm calling basic claims. And the reason I'm doing this is because anytime you talk about a major world religious tradition and you talk about major theological claims, there's always presuppositions that can be problematized or challenged, and that we could look at some of those in the Q&A. There's no reason why not. But I'm just trying to kind of here elaborate some things that are presupposed, because you can't read everything, and I'm just kind of setting the stage in the background. And if some of these claims are problematic, or at least need to be thought about more, that's normal to engage with, but they're more fundamental presuppositions of Christianity. So, in the background, the idea in Christian redemption theory is that there is, as it were, one unique source of all created reality, which is God. That's to say, monotheism is affirmed. And God is the creator of all things, who is mysterious, incomprehensible, and in some real sense personal. So the whole theory presupposes that God is really very transcendent and numinous, but also, despite that, in some sense personal. You might call it a personal ultimate reality. The second presupposition I'm just taking from the start here is that every human person sometimes does things that are morally unjust and do lasting harm to other persons, to relationships between persons, to one's own internal being. That's to say, one does damage to oneself through moral injustice, and to one's relationship to the transcendent mystery of God. Okay, so in a way, it's a major claim, but in another sense, it's rather intuitive. The point is that great moral failings in our own lives can do harm to human relationships between ourselves, can harm us in ourselves, and whether we are cognizant of it or not can inhibit and harm our relationship to that ultimate transcendent reality that is God. Okay. The third presupposition is that no human being can repair or restore the spiritual and moral health of the whole human race in any of these three respects I've just named, our relationship with others, our relationship to ourselves, our relationship to God, by our own powers. Nor can all human beings do this acting collectively. As if you or I could form a society, a learned and virtuous society, to restore the human race to its plenary moral and religious health by our own natural powers. Okay? We're going to fix everything. What's your ambition like? We're going to fix everything. We're going to start with Middle East conflict. We're going to move out from there to global warming, and we're going to then take on economic difficulties. I'm not saying we can't make any moral progress by learned and virtuous societies, but I'm talking kind of about, you know, universal, extensive, like, reparation. Fifthly, God fittingly has become human in the person of Jesus, so that he might, as a human being, restore the human community to its relationship with God, so as to repair by grace the relationship of human beings to one another, and so as to heal human beings, you might say, from within ourselves. Right? So this is a fundamental claim of Christianity, that God has become human, and that in doing so, God has begun to repair the human situation or condition from within, as it were, by being the most human of us all. No one is more human than God, you might put it that way. And that in being the most human of all, God has instantiated, as it were, a new beginning for the human race. And lastly, the presupposition is that God communicates participation in this mystery of his reparation of the world to others by virtue of the grace of Christ. grace, that grace is something real, that there's a possibility of participating in the life of grace, which is given to us numinously, albeit really, by Christ. These are all massive claims. They're all inherently, potentially interesting, controversial, disputable, and they raise all kinds of interesting problems and questions. But I'm actually just presupposing them. I'm happy to welcome, you know, questions about them, but I'm just giving those as a background sketch. Now let's consider briefly some objections to classic, that kind of, those kinds of claims. I'm gonna consider three, I think, fairly influential challenges that are not, these are not comprehensive challenges, but they're challenges that are in the air, so to speak, that we breathe in, or that we have heard, or that we may ourselves wonder about, or worry about, or be convicted by. And the first one, I'm just going to sketch them out rapidly. Each of the three thinkers I'm going to think about here has massive amounts of detailed reflection on these issues, but it's just, they're nice touchstones. So the first is Gotthold Lessing. In case you don't sit around reading the collective works of Gotthold Lessing, he lives 1729 to 1781, so roughly synonymous in his mature career with the American Revolution. And Lessing is one of the first Enlightenment moderns to give a very poignant expression to the objection that there's problems in believing in a unique mediator because of religious pluralism. He has a famous parable in his book, Nathan the Wise, about three rings, in which the king had three sons that represent Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and he fabricated three, an original ring, which is like the true ring of inheritance of the truth. The king represents God. But he also didn't want the other two sons to be excluded, so he made artificial rings for them that aren't actually genuine, but they were so well made you couldn't tell the difference of which one was authentic. He gave them to the three sons, and now it's not even clear. There's different legends. Maybe the original ring was lost, and you have three fabricated rings. None of them are real, really authentic. Maybe you have one of the three. No one can tell. The sons go through a great kind of internal tribulation as they pass these things down. No one really is sure where the original ring is. And the argument in the end of the parable is that each one should live according to the tradition he has received as best he can, and if he practices the works of holiness and merit, his ring may seem to be the most real. Right? You get the idea that you can't really tell what the original revelation was, if there was an original monotheistic revelation, but we can encourage followers of these religious traditions to live in the most noble ways. And in a certain way, Lessing wants to move away, of course, from a dogmatically normative claim about any religious truth towards the idea that religions should be evaluated primarily by what we might call naturalistic criteria. How well do they contribute to the common society of human beings according to standards of mere human reason? And this is Enlightenment standards of pure human reason. So you might say, according to, if you're in the Catholic tradition, you might say, how well does to different religious traditions contribute to the keeping of the natural law and the upkeep of civic society according to the norms of reason that all human beings can agree upon? And what I've given you here is this famous quote where he tries to problematize belief in the incarnation by claiming that the problem is that, you know, we can speculate about whether Alexander the Great really lived, and it's reasonable to believe that he did, but no one is going to risk their life plausibly on the question of whether Alexander the Great did this or did exist or did this or didn't do this. But with the claim about Jesus Christ, the Christian who intentionally believes in the incarnation takes their fundamental evaluation of reality from this contingent fact of history, and in doing so departs from universal canons of reason that everyone can consent to in all times and all places. Because of the facticity that God became this human being here with this human flesh there, and at this time and place lived and died and was raised from the dead, and has revealed himself in this particular, you might call it, ecclesial tradition. This all seems so delimiting, okay, against which, you know, he wants to open a possibility of different mediations. And in fact, Lessing really wants to problematize all the mediations, all the religious traditions, insofar as they would claim to have any kind of absolute authority, are all in some way necessarily arbitrary. Okay? You can kind of feel the weight of that criticism, its inherent rationality, but also its kind of contemporary plausibility. I mean, it's influential. A second very related objection I'm taking from the contemporary religious religious pluralism theorist John Hick, who died this year, I think, who I once heard speak in, at Brown, not far from where we're standing. And in his famously controversial book from the 70s, The Myth of God Incarnate, he talks about how different religious traditions enshrine with meaning different mediating figures, like the Buddha, or, well, Muhammad, but especially his writing in the Quran, or Jesus of Nazareth, or any other number of figures that are perhaps a little more opaque, but that we could name, and creates customs around them to what he calls to give articulation to the meaning of ultimate reality. Now, the word ultimate reality for God instead of God is very meaningful for Hick. He is uncomfortable with the claim that we can know that God is personal. Now, so if you believe in the incarnation, that God personally became present to us in a human historical life, and the atonement has, in a way, manifest the identity of God in time, then you believe God's personal, and you believe that God has personally made himself present to us in a particular human historical life. And Hick wants to problematize that because he, in part, wants to move away from requiring the association of God with personal characteristics. And we can feel the weight of that. I mean, in the I'm spiritual but not religious objection, right? I mean, you have a lot of people who would say, I'm worried about dogmas or religious traditions characterizing God in distinctive ways. I do believe there's something spiritual and numinous behind like man's religious, human being's religious quest for the absolute, but I don't think we should necessarily want to delimit it by characterizing it as personal. Okay, so that's another contemporary objection. I think it's very acute. Now, the third one is about Calvin on substitutionary atonement theory. Now, this is a little bit different. This is to go to a very different direction and look at a dogmatic claim that's very widespread in modern religious culture. I mean, it's a minority subgroup, but it's a rather vivid one. If you have any background in evangelical Christianity in America, you've probably been exposed to some extent to Calvin's atonement theory, whether you were aware of it or not. And it's subject to a lot of dispute, and I want to demarcate differences between Calvin and Aquinas. Part of it is, well, to name it, to put it under a title, it's called penal substitutionary theory. Penal, of course, means punishment. Substitution, meaning Christ took on the punishment that was due to the human race, due to our sinfulness and the gravity of our moral misconduct. Okay. So Calvin's object basically is an adherent to penal substitutionary theory who believes that Christ is wholly morally innocent and is himself God made man, but that Christ took upon himself by the will of God the punishments of divine wrath and the purity, you might say the purity of divine wrath, the purity of transcendent divine justice, was, as it were, rested on Christ in the act of the crucifixion, in the atonement event, so that we would not be the bearers of divine punishment. So God transfers the punishment due to the human race onto one, who is Christ, and he transfers the innocence and righteousness, the justification, the justice and righteousness of Christ, onto the human race. So Calvin's very self-conscious about this. The mystery of divine punition rests upon Christ in the crucifixion. The mystery of justification, or the rendering of the human being righteous extrinsically, that's to say without changing us in ourselves, is a fruit of Christ's atoning power and work. There are people in the Catholic tradition who hold something like penal substitutionary theory, or at least elements of it. But a typical critique one hears is that it sounds a little too sadistic. There are two problems. One, it sounds sadistic, as if God is in some way needs to express the vehemence of divine wrath as a condition to restore the human race to friendship with God. You know, like to put it in terms that I think are unfair to Calvin, but nevertheless maybe a little helpful. God needs to strike somebody as a condition for embracing the world. And he's going to first strike Christ, and then he's going to embrace the world. As we'll see, Aquinas completely rejects this view and thinks it's deeply problematic. The second aspect of the criticism is that Christ is innocent. And so how can one who is morally innocent be the bearer of punishment? I mean, that would be to prolong the problems of human injustice. There's a lot of that happening in the history of the human race already in our day-to-day lives, of people who don't merit punishments or are treated unfairly being subject to punishment. So we wouldn't want to see that prolonged on a divine and cosmic level. Now, there's ways to defend Calvin, but I'm just kind of presenting that because I think when you talk about atonement, actually in the popular evangelical imagination, a lot of people do work with this concept, and I want to clearly demarcate it from what I'm going to present. All right, so having made some introductions and objections, I want to turn to Aquinas' main treatment of the question. You know, the Summa Theologiae is one of Aquinas' major works. It's often thought to be the major work, and happily or unhappily, if you want to study Aquinas seriously, it's just one of his major works, but it is his mature, final work. And in the third part of the Summa Theologiae, he really wrote a whole book about Jesus, the atonement, the sacraments. It's very rich. And he really takes up the question of, like, the, you might call it, to put it in overly, I don't like the word exactly, but the mechanism of the atonement, or like, what is really going on when Christ restores the human race to friendship with God. He has a lot of things to say about this in lots of different places, and there's lots of different sides of it, some of which bear great resemblance to Eastern Christianity and to Athanasius or Cyril of Alexandria. But here he really is in question 48, article 2, which I've given you, which is the major article on this subject. He's really following Anselm here, but he's also reinterpreting Anselm. Whether Christ's passion brought about our salvation by way of atonement. Now, atonement is not an old Latin word, interestingly. It's an old English word. It's a 16th century English derivative word, and it really, if you break it into little three little bits, it's at-one-ment, reconciliation in unity. So it's not a Latin word. It means at-one-ment, to bring together into reconciliation what has been alienated or separated. So that's a very beautiful way to think about the word atonement, like reconciliation and communion. So whether Christ's passion brought about our salvation by way of communion or reconciliation. But actually the Latin word that the English translator is using there is it's a Dominican from 1920 who decided to put that word in. The word in Latin is satisfactio. You can see why he didn't put that word in, because in modern English that would mean like the satisfying of one's appetites or something. But satisfactio in the Latin medieval context means something like making reparation. And what we'll see him talking about is like, you've offended someone who's a friend, you've wounded their heart, you go out to them and, you know, try to repair the damage. That's the kind of making of reparation through an interpersonal action. Okay, so here, the atonement's a beautiful word, but really it's like satisfactio as like reconciliation with someone in a case where there's been personal alienation. I'm going to read the article and I'm going to talk about it. Whether Christ's passion brought about our salvation by way of atonement. I answer that. He properly atones or makes satisfaction for an offense who offers something which the offended one loves equally or even more than he detested the offense. Okay, so Aquinas just starts with like a general kind of rule about relationships between persons. So going back to the basic presuppositions, the basic claims, it's an interpersonal universe. We are persons. We live in relationship with other persons, relationships of love and justice, or of unloveliness, not loveliness, and injustice. And friendship, or the ruptures and betrayals of friendship, or goodness, or the privation of goodness, which is moral evil. And we live all that out underneath, as it were, God and relationship to God in God's personalistic, with the possibility of personalistically relating to God. Okay. And if you offend someone in the human realm, you can see what he's talking about. I already gave kind of the example that, does this take too much psychological ingenuity to see this? If you've offended someone at a certain proportionate degree of gravity, Let's say you've really gotten, I mean, let's just take a kind of standard example, standard human example. You've gotten really angry, just, you know, disproportionately angry with a parent or a sibling, and you've really lashed out. You really let your tongue go, you know, wild, and you said things you shouldn't have said. Okay, then what is the proportionate way to repair that act? I mean, you know, if you really speak harshly to a parent and you bear more of the moral culpability for it, you can't really just call the next week and say, hey, how are things going? You know, that's not the mature, at least. Parents put up a lot of that, but it's not really the mature relation way to do so. Or if siblings feel deeply betrayed by their other sibling, you know, like, how do you repair that relationship authentically? It requires usually something proportionate. Now, the whole idea of proportionality here is a kind of, it's kind of intangible, like, because it has to do with how do you just show enough intensity of love. Like, I love this person enough to repair the damage I did to my relationship with them by doing something proportionately caring in compensation. Now he goes on. But by suffering out of love and obedience unto God the Father, Christ gave more to God than was required to compensate for the offense of the whole human race. Okay, so that's a strong claim, a very vivid one. He's claiming that there's something more inherently proportionately meaningful in the love of Christ for God lived out in the torture, dereliction, and crucifixion and death of the cross than that which the whole human race could do proportionately in offense to God. Now, you may be scratching your head at this point. That's a very strong claim. Right? The goodness of Christ crucified for Aquinas is greater in intensity proportionately than all the particular evil of the human race. Why? Okay, first of all, because of the exceeding charity from which he suffered. Secondly, on account of the dignity of his life which he laid down in atonement, for it was the life of one who was God and man. Thirdly, on account of the extent of the passion and the greatness of the grief endured, as we've stated above. And therefore, Christ's passion was not only sufficient, but actually a superabundant atonement for the sins of the whole human race, according to 1 John 2:2. He is the propitiation for our sins, but not for ours only, but also for those of the whole world. Now, before I comment on this, I want to also just read Reply to Objection 3, which comes a little further down in this part of the Summa, where he says this: the dignity of Christ's flesh is not to be estimated solely from the nature of flesh, meaning his human embodiment, his human body, but also from the person assuming it, namely, insofar as it was God's flesh, the result of which is that it was of infinite worth. Now, I want to say a couple things here. First of all, when you start to think about, like, the concept of sin, I think for Christian theology, sin is a theological mystery. And not, I mean, there is some degree in which, you know, if I hear somebody say, well, you know, all human beings are sinners, and then they start to make the case, which I put in a very benign way at the beginning, all human beings fail with regards to human justice. You can accept that in the order of natural reason, just like anybody. Anybody can basically say, yeah, if there is such a thing as moral fault at all, probably all people commit some moral faults. But when you get into the concept of sin, properly speaking, the presupposition is that actually human beings need to be enlightened as to what sin is by first encountering by first being aware of the reality of the mystery of Christ. So if I go back to that idea of grace, it's actually considered a grace in Catholic theology to be aware of the mystery of sin. You would say, well, that sounds really morbid. Catholics like sin, and they are now claiming it's a grace to have some awareness of it. But actually, the claim is that it's liberating to be aware of one's own potential alienation from God, other people, and from oneself through evil, because it is accompanied by a capacity for transformation. It's not to be aware of being weak or limited or selfish for its own sake, but in view of the possibility of the help of transformation by grace. So part of the, you know, problem here is that we're looking at things, in thinking about sin, you're looking at things kind of the other side of the mystery, which is the second thing. The first thing is the mystery of the presence of Christ redeeming the human race. And in light of that redemption, you start to think, well, okay, if there is such a thing as a redemption, I mean, if atonement theory could really be true, what does that say about the moral kind of frailty of the human race? But also, what does that say about the capacity of God to transform the human race? And how might the human race be liberated? Now, when he looks at the three reasons, I think the second reason is actually the one to take as fundamental, and that's the fact that Christ is himself God. So behind this is a kind of classic Eastern Christian view that Aquinas holds, that the first mystery of our salvation in the Christian understanding of the world is the incarnation, because by becoming human, God has united the human race to himself. So whereas the human race could live in alienation from God and ignorance of God and just basically, you might call it indifference or just ignorance, you know, nescience, unawareness, okay? God has made it possible to bridge, as it were, our relationship to God so that we can know him because God's become human. I mean, it does help you get a leg up. If God exists, it really does help you start to make some first paths if God becomes one of us and then reveals to us what God is in our own human, as it were, figure. But it also means for Aquinas that Christ has an infinite dignity that is incalculable, because there's a kind of infinite depth to the mystery of who Jesus of Nazareth is. Jesus is not just a human being who has lived and died among us 2,000 years ago, but is actually also himself divine. And we don't really entirely know what God is, but there's a kind of irradiation of knowledge or a radiance of knowledge of what God is made possible because God has become human. And that mystery of God becoming human is at the base of the crucifixion, because in the crucifixion you really have God present experiencing human suffering in its depths and, as it were, offering his own human obedience and love to God the Father on our behalf, that in a way that God has come from within our human condition to humanly repair our human condition. In that sense, there's an infinite dignity, there's like a mysterious infinite dignity to Christ crucified. The first reason he gives is a more sort of formal reason, meaning like the essence of what's going on, is that Christ in his human heart is without sin and lives in a plenitude of charity. So the idea here is, you might call it, it's not substitution, penal substitution, but it is substitutionary atonement. It's not Calvin's idea that Christ undergoes punishment for us. It's that where we have often failed to love or to be just or to be merciful or to be kind or to be charitable, Christ has been perfectly just, good, kind, merciful, and charitable, and has perfected our human nature from within, and made possible to us by his capital grace, the grace that he shares with the world by virtue of his life, death, and resurrection, he's made possible for us to participate in that healing mystery of grace. Like the human victory of love that Christ lives in the crucifixion is something that then is bequeathed to the church. So think about Luke's image of Christ saying, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Into your hands I commend my spirit. This kind of deep peace in the human heart of Christ that's depicted by Luke, where he's united with the Father in obedience and united and even able to mysteriously show mercy and forgiveness to his unjust persecutors who execute him. That this kind of victorious human charity, this charity of the grace of God in the human heart of Christ, is made available to the human race. And thirdly, although that God could have lived through that in his human nature without suffering, the suffering is not, Aquinas says, required, either because God is vindictive or God needs to punish someone, but actually it's the intensity of suffering, the intensity of the gravity of suffering Christ for Aquinas stems from us, from the human race, or from particular members of our human race, who have the same problems the rest of us have, who did grave violence to Christ. So the intensity of suffering doesn't come from God's will, but from human maliciousness. And so it exposes the sort of problem of human violence and human malice and the non-innocence of our human condition. But against that backdrop, it exposes also the intensity of the love of Christ. So you say, why does Christ suffer so grievously at the cross for Aquinas? That's kind of going two directions. One direction is from us to Christ. He suffers grievously because he, in the face of his innocence and holiness, powers in the human race that are not healthy come out to the forefront and are exposed as in a certain way, destructive powers. Right? So the cross represents, as it were, a critique of human violence and human injustice. And on the other hand, the intensity of the suffering manifests the intensity of Christ's love for the human race. So there's a kind of radiance of the human victory of Christ's love in the midst of the most dire of circumstances. And this is a theme you might call a theme of solidarity, that God has shown his solidarity with victims of violence and evil. And so he's not just, as it were, able to pardon those who persecute him. He's also able to come to the aid with his redemptive grace, his healing grace, to those who are themselves subject to the most unjust and grievous mistreatments. And so that he shows solidarity with us in our own suffering. Let me just respond. So, I mean, I'm just going to respond before Professor Harvey says some words. I'm going to just respond a little bit to the objections. Now, I'll just tell you the other passages I gave you here. The first one from 46.2, question 46.2, is where he says that God didn't really have to become incarnate to save us. It's not a strict requirement of justice, but it's a more intense expression of mercy. And the reason it's a more intense expression of mercy is that by becoming human and living out a perfectly just life among us, God has made it possible for us to participate in the justice of Christ, and to give us a participation in the justice of Christ, in his righteousness, and in his grace, is yet more merciful. So you don't want to get the idea that like God had to do it this way because God is bound by the logic of the incarnation, the atonement, like a math problem. And if he didn't work the math problem out this way, you could have never gotten the solution. Kind of per modo geometrico. God's bound by some inexorable logic. God is transcendent. He could do things in many ways. But he's done something in a wise and merciful way by communicating to us the justice of Christ as a greater mercy. We can really live in friendship with Christ in his justice. Secondly, he then says this can be communicated to us. I've got this little snippet from question 48, article 2, applied objection 1. It's the same article we've been studying, where he says we're one mystic person. So we can, by life in the Spirit, we can begin to participate, despite our weaknesses and our failures, we can begin to participate in Christ's charity and his compassion. And then I have this last passage from 46.3, just to show you, he shows like five different ways Christ saved us. He's got lists like this elsewhere that are actually even different. So you can find, if you go through, you can find like 8 or 10 different ways that Christ saved us by becoming incarnate. So it's not like the one, I've given you one of the main explanations. It's like the Royal Highway explanation in Aquinas, but there's lots of other tributaries and side roads, and he doesn't hold the theory I give you exclusively. He holds it inclusively with other theories. So just to finish now and give you a couple of responses, the objection of Lessing is about the particularity of the incarnation and its historical contingency. There's a lot of sides to that. One is a problem about knowledge, like how could, if God really became human in history, how could I know him now? That's actually a problem you see even in John's Gospel, in the resurrection scene in John 20, when Jesus presents himself to, resurrected from the dead, to Thomas, and says, come put your hands in the side and touch the resurrected body. And he says, blessed are those who've, blessed, you know, you've seen and believe, blessed are those who have not seen and believe. This is really a problem about the cognition of faith, supernatural faith. Can Christ enlighten a person so that they can have a certain knowledge that Christ is really personally alive and present? To which, of course, the Christian tradition says yes. It isn't the same kind of knowledge that's given through like geometrical mathematics or empirical science. But then there's a lot of kinds of knowledge of singular persons that isn't given in a universal, demonstrable way, like the knowledge I have that my mother loves me. You can't prove that from geometrical axioms or from empirical experiments. You'll never prove that your mother loves you from an empirical experiment, like by watching her brain under a neuroscanner. And there's a lot of non-trivial knowledge we gain including a lot of non-trivial philosophical knowledge we gain through individual engagements with people. But the real issue is about the scandal of particularity, as I'm framing it, which is this idea that, you know, if God works through one religious tradition, doesn't that delimit the truth of other traditions and seem arbitrary and potentially epistemologically unjust, that I have to believe one thing is true and then I have to rule out of court all the others. Clearly that we don't want to claim something quite like that. Theologians here talk about the scandal of particularity, that God chose a particular people in time, which is the people of Israel, that God became a particular human being, which is Jesus of Nazareth, that God is present through in history through a particular ecclesial tradition of the Christian church. And that is potentially scandalous because it suggests delimitation, determination, and exclusion. But you might also think about it this way. We are embodied human beings. We're not just souls that work through absolute knowledge and universal of universal kinds. We do. We also encounter one another through physicality and embodiment. And so it's deeply meaningful, universally for all human beings in all times and places, if God took on particular physical embodiment for me, for everyone. Right? So there's a kind of universality about God taking on particular human embodiment that's actually really existentially vivid, which is that God has shown solidarity with all times and places of human beings in all times and places by becoming a particular, by taking on our human condition in its contingency. Right? So actually the thing that Lessing thinks is a weakness, the contingency of Christ in his human historicity and embodiment, is actually potentially a really great strength, that God took on the contingent, singular embodiment of our human condition and has redeemed us from within it. And you can hold this view without being theologically totalitarian or exclusivist by holding that the Christian tradition can learn a great deal through its dialogue with other religious traditions, and that there is a lot of wisdom in not only the philosophical patrimony of humanity, but in religious studies, so to speak, or in the study of world religious traditions. And then you get into a theological set of reflections, like theological engagement with Islam, theological engagement with Hinduism, theological engagement with Buddhism. And those are really rich studies, fields of study. So it's because you have a religious, and I would say it even this way, even more, like a little bit dialectically, because you have a religious engagement in Christ, these other religious claims now appear interesting. And actually, you take them more seriously in their potentially universal scope, and not so the conversation doesn't end, the conversation begins in a certain way. Now there are determining factors of believing in the exclusive like reality of the incarnation, but that also opens you up to the universal human search for God in characteristic ways. And so it can be a very inclusive and open thing to believe in the incarnation. Last thing to say, and this was the claim about like the spiritual, not religious, claim about, well, maybe God is numinously non-personal. And here I would just refer you to the famous story Stephen Hawking tells of when Bertrand Russell was once giving a public lecture on how our sun and stars are cosmically, you know, relative to the wider galaxy. And he was basically giving a kind of materialistic summary of kind of cosmic physics. And a little old lady stood up in the back after the talk and said, "What you have told us is rubbish. The world is really a flat plate supported by the back of a giant tortoise." The scientist gave a superior smile before replying, "What is the tortoise standing on?" "You're very clever, young man, very clever," said the old lady, "but it's turtles all the way down." Okay, you maybe have heard this idea. So the universe is turtles all the way down, which is, of course, a silly and interesting thing to say. But for Christians, actually, it is persons all the way down. So the answer to the Christian, you know, the Christian answer is, I think, that personhood is not an arbitrary accident of the cosmos, but our human personal relationships of communion, of friendship, of justice, of injustice, of love and responsibility are constitutive of what's most precious in the universe, and this has its transcendent origin in God, who is a communion of persons. So in the beginning, the Christian would say there is a communion of persons, and the universe exists for personal reasons, the personal reasons that God gave the world existence, but also the personal communion of created human persons. So I mean, I think Christianity is committed to this idea that it's persons all the way down, sir, but it's a very defensible claim. Philosophically and theologically, it's a very beautiful and rich claim to claim that the universe is made by persons and for persons. I'm happy to ask Professor Harvey to come up and give us some responses. Please help me welcome Professor Susan Harvey.
I'm just going to say a couple things because this is really not my kind of work, and I feel quite, it's a different kind of discussion than I'm normally involved in. So I'm going to do two things which are quite different from what Father Thomas Joseph has done, and maybe they'll be helpful and maybe they weren't. The first is I just want to say a couple of words. In Byzantine tradition, in Orthodox Christianity, you know, think a little bit differently about the fall. It's not that there isn't a notion of the fall, of course there is, but a doctrine of original sin is really not something that Byzantine tradition and Orthodox Christianity has formulated in that particular way. And so I just wanted to cite, and of course Father Thomas Joseph did also, an example of the kind of perspective that pervades Orthodox theology would be that offered by Athanasius of Alexandria in the 4th century in his work on the Incarnation. It's a wonderful work. But he talks there about the fall as a tragedy. And he talks about the fact that because of the fall, because of Adam and Eve's decision, we live in a continuing condition of tragedy. And it's not because in some way they deformed us or rendered us evil or because humanity is evil, but it's tragic. And because of what Adam and Eve did, we die. And mortality is a tragic condition in which to live because it separates us. It separates us from people we love, separates us from the world, which is a good creation. So as Father Thomas Joseph was saying, that separation is our loss, and this is our condition of tragedy. And Athanasius has this wonderful passage where he says, what should God have done? What could God do? Couldn't throw away a creation. He made a really good creation, so he's not going to throw it away. So what could God do? There used to be a commercial about laundry detergent. You know, what's a mother to do? What could God do? So God's response, according to Athanasius and all other great theologians, including Thomas Aquinas, is that God's response to the tragedy of the fall is not to throw away the old creation and make a new one, but to recreate that creation. So this is the incarnation, to enter into the full and whole reality of what we are, and from within us and our reality to begin the process of that new creation. So there is no longer a separation between creator and created because God has become the very reality that we are in. And any efficacy of crucifixion must depend on this notion of incarnation. I spend a lot of time in my secular classroom trying to have students think about what the word incarnation really means. And I always like to point out, because I'm a vegetarian, that the way you remember incarnation, chili con carne is chili with meat, right? So incarnate is about flesh. The word becomes flesh and dwells among us. So any efficacy of the crucifixion must depend on the fact that it is God become human. So the really important moment of God's work is the incarnation, because we would have no crucifixion without it and no resurrection. So that's just a piece of Orthodox perspective. And then what I want to really do, just in just a very few minutes, is to ask a genuinely humble question. And that is, let us talk about the 99% for 1 minute and not the 1%. How do absolutely plain, ordinary people understand or encounter or experience what this is? Okay, I sing in the choir at my church. People couldn't even read this title. Thomas Joseph's talk tonight, but they know what he's talking about. How do they know that? So my suggestion to you is that the way you know, so I'm going to use an example from Orthodox Christianity, and then I will leave it to the rest of you in the room to give me what the analogous example would be from Roman Catholicism. In Orthodoxy, you would know this reality if you go to church. You would know it from the liturgy. How would you know it? So now we need a picture. Ah, okay. And how do I? I'm just going to tell you, or
you can tell me, or you can move these little arrow on the keyboard.
This one.
Yep.
That very one. Okay. So somewhere around the 8th century or 9th century, Byzantine theologians decided that every single Orthodox church, so to this day, should have an icon of the resurrection. I brought one, which I'll show you afterward. And so you walk into an Orthodox church, you're going to see two things. Think about what you see when you walk into it. You walk into an Orthodox church, you're going to see a big icon of Christ enthroned in glory. You might see a crucifix. Some Orthodox churches have crucifix. Certainly they have a cross, but you might not see it. But you're going to see this. And you'll see this over the door. So you actually won't see it until you leave at the end of liturgy. What is this icon? So here you have Christ resurrecting from the dead, and then Greek word for that is Anastasis, and he's tramping down the gates of Hades, tramping down the place of the dead. And he's raising Adam and Eve from the dead and all of the righteous with them. So in this case, the kings and prophets of the Hebrew Bible. But here are Adam and Eve. Here are Adam and Eve, not at the tree, not at the moment of the fall. How many images of Eve have you ever seen? The example I like to use for my students is, why in advertisement do we use the phrase sinfully delicious? Why does that mean something in our culture, and why would seeing a woman's red lips biting into an apple mean something to you? It would mean it because of who you think Eve is. But if you're Orthodox, that's not an Eve you see. This is the Eve that you see every time you walk into church and every time you leave here. This is Eve restored, Adam restored, risen from the dead. I just want to show you a couple examples. This is actually my absolute favorite example of this icon, although it's not the most beautiful in the universe, but I love it. Here's Christ trapping down the gates of death. Here's Adam and Eve. Here are the Old Testament righteous and the prophets and the New Testament saints. And we're all in there, but look at Adam and Eve. Look at them. Look at them. Look at them. Look how old they are. How long they've been waiting. Life comes back to them through that touch. So the most famous example of this and the most glorious is in Istanbul in the Karaite Jami in the 14th century. So, you know, Christ in absolute glory, traveling down, raising Adam and Eve from the dead, and with them, all of us. A local example, I wanted to bring an example from Pawtucket, but I couldn't get a picture of it. It's really beautiful. This is a stained glass window in West Roxbury. This is actually behind the altar instead of over the door. But in most, and I love this, look at how spiky he is. Light. And Adam and Eve. And this is the way you normally see it, and the icon I brought looks like this now. And so if you're Orthodox, this icon is in every church you walk in, this icon is in cards that you send to people, this icon is in your house, you take it home with you. This icon is everywhere, but most importantly, it is over the door of the church that you will leave at the end of liturgy each week. You come into liturgy, and in Orthodoxy, we have long services. In Orthodoxy, you come into liturgy, and the service of matins is going on. We call it Orthros. And it will end, and the liturgy proper, the Mass, will begin. And unless you have a really well-trained ear, you're not going to know the one is ended and the next one is begun, or unless you watch for the you move from the chant or stand to the choir. When the choir starts singing, oh, okay, that's the moment. But you come in at the end of Matins, or even if you come in the middle of Matins, let's imagine you're really, really faithful and you get there early. About halfway through Matins, you're going to hear the hymn. You're going to hear it every single Sunday of the year, without exception, and probably every weekday if you went every. Right in the middle, you're just going to hear this line about Adam is redeemed from sin, and Eve has joy in place of sadness. You're going to hear that every week. And in the final moments of Matins, just before Mass begins, you're going to hear, Adam is recalled from the dead, the curse is made void, Eve is set free, and we are endowed with life. Every week, every time you enter the church, Adam is recalled from the dead, the curse is made void, Eve is set free, death is slain, and we are endowed with life. And at the end of the liturgy, after you receive communion, you're going to turn out and you're going to walk out the church door underneath this icon, and you're going to look at Adam and Eve raised from the dead. Sometimes you may even hear some other hymns, you know, my favorites are the one where the kind of Eve whose head was bowed now raises her head with joy. Eve whose mouth was closed now sings with joy. Let Eve uncover her face and sing with joy. Let Eve reveal her face and sing to you, O Lord, for her shamefacedness has passed away. Let her hear the message of peace, for her daughter has repaid her debt. Today the mouth of Eve has been opened so she can sing with an exalted voice and with careful confidence that her fault has been forgiven. This is a very intimate and a very wondrous relationship with Adam and Eve. It is not one in which you are constantly dwelling upon the agony of whatever happened at the tree. It is a relationship in which you know that there is life, because this one takes you by the hand and raises you up. And I suspect, though people don't have the kind of vocabulary of an Aquinas or a Lessing or a Calvin or even a Father Thomas Joseph White, I suspect that if you ask people to talk about what this icon means to them, however simple that language would be, it would come close simply because it is known in a relationship that is real, and which they know in their ordinariness, just the ordinariness of practicing their belief. And hopefully, their lives are changed by that. And thank you very much.
Well, I think we should open questions to either speaker. In fact, we will open questions to either speaker. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I don't really have a big question, but I want to hear more about the mystery of sin and of grace, and maybe how that relates to what we just heard. Some maybe just a little bit more detail on how sin relates to, because we saw kind of like how Christ figures in the whole story, and we saw some.
Yeah, okay, so the question is, how does a little bit more about like the mystery of sin and its thinking about it from a Christian perspective. So I think that what Professor Harvey did there was very, very helpful for giving, as it were, a kind of diptych profile of, you have the kind of, you know, image of the Passion, the theology of the Passion, and you have the image of the theology of the Resurrection, and it's another dimension of the redemption. Which has to be spoken about as really central. And you can think about sin in, I mean, well, I think when I, a beautiful image of in reading of Athanasius on the effects of, Catholics will say, original sin,
as tragic, that there's some, like, you know, so one way to think about sin that's very helpful in contrast to the mystery of resurrected life is in terms of tragedy in human existence, and not just tragedy of the fact that we're born into a world where we are in some way, we have internal disequilibrium and vulnerability and likelihood to fail in our relationship with God and other people, but also where even when we try to conduct ourselves well, we're going to be sort of riddled with difficulties and failures and frailties. You know, I mean, obviously, with regards to sin, there's a lot in the Western tradition of dispute, right, with regards to the Catholic and Protestant traditions. The Council of Trent famously teaches that the human being is wounded by sin, but the imago Dei, the image of God in us, is not destroyed. So the fundamental inclinations of human nature remain good. Human being is fundamentally oriented toward the good and can achieve some moral and intellectual good on it by its own natural powers, but that these things are wounded. And that's where you get, so you get a kind of tragedy in the Western Catholic tradition, this Tridentine kind of vision, because the human being still remains fundamentally inclined toward the good, but then also riddled with frailties, okay? So it's not as kind of catastrophic as the theory of radical depravity, which makes things more kind of dramatic, you know, since the Imago Dei appears only, really, it's certainly only in Christ. You've also got a question, so in that, in sort of along that line of thinking then, you know, the victory of the resurrection, the restoration of the resurrection, casts a light upon the tragic aspect of human life as now not having the final word. So what's really rich about Christianity is you can accommodate the realism of acknowledging tragedy, and you can truly mourn, but you aren't allowing that to have the kind of final say as to what human existence is. Okay, so that's one side of an answer. And then the other side, I would say, there's an old debate, I'm stereotyping it a little bit, but it's a helpful, it's between Lutherans and Reformed, meaning Calvinists, on knowledge of sin, because Luther famously argues that the first effect of grace is to make you aware of your sinfulness, and then your need for righteousness, to which the mystery of Christ's redemption is a kind of answer. The Calvinist perspective is that Christ reveals to you his own mystery of righteousness, our beauty, and then we see our own human deformity in the face of the beauty of Christ. And there are different ways, I mean, neither of these were required among Protestants or Catholics as ways of taking things, but I do think that Aquinas definitely is closer to Calvin on this point. That it's the cognitive experience of grace that makes us more intensively aware of our sinfulness. And in the Catholic tradition, we like to say something like this, like, the greatest saints become more and more increasingly aware of their own sinfulness, and the greatest sinners become more and more convicted that they're saints. You know, the point is that human self, like, the dynamic towards human self-justification, human self-righteousness can become more and more delusional, but the dynamic of grace is to make us more vulnerable in good ways. So, like, when we talk about sin in a non-morbid way in the Catholic tradition, what that means is, like, the awareness of my own deep vulnerability and moral vulnerability and limitations is an opportunity to grow in my direct awareness spiritually of my dependence on Christ. So it's an opportunity. The enlightenment, we also say this way, when the light of Christ shines more deeply on the soul, it makes us more aware of the shadows and darkness in ourselves. But this is actually an opportunity to allow the light of Christ to come in. And that kind of dependence doesn't make us weaker, it makes us stronger because we become more aware of our real capacity with Christ to love and to be in the truth. And so, you know, not being ever afraid of the fullness of the truth, because the fullness of the truth is going to make us free. And so, you know, part of the story, so it's really hard to treat sin without falling into caricatures, but when you treat it in this way, it's actually in view of a, like a deeper idea of a kind of positive growth, a therapeutic healing. That we can't do by ourselves, but that it can happen with Christ.
Yes, sir.
So, could you further touch upon the notion of the compatibility between particular incarnation and universal interreligious dialogue? Because, you know, in reading this passage from John Hale, he seems to argue that the theology of the incarnation has a cultural aspect to it.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, I mean, in a way, the first thing I say is that Catholic is, you know, just theologically, grace doesn't destroy nature, and culture is part of nature. So all religious tradition, all if there is such a thing as divinely revealed religious truth, it's going to be mediated through cultures, and all the creative impulses of culture, whether it be artistic, philosophical, and, you know, to the extent that conceptual constructions are somewhat vehicles of different cultures and times and places, that's all going to enter into any religious tradition, including one that would have a core element of truth in it, or that would be fundamentally true. But I would say, with regards to, let me say one thing that's polemical about Hick and one thing that's rapprochement. So the polemical thing I would say is, if you want to delimit the possibility of God taking a step toward us in the incarnation from the beginning a priori, in order to allow God to be more universal, you're also banning God from being encountered in a concrete way, given our physical condition. So we are animals. This is a very Dominican way to answer. We are animals. And animals encounter people through the senses. As Professor Harvey was saying, you know, concretely people encounter the mystery of a religious tradition of salvation and a religious tradition hidden through sensate actions of animals who worship in liturgical ways or who think in and through traditional historical communities and cultures. So it just makes sense in a certain way from our argument of fittingness, not of requirement or necessity, that God should encounter us in our human historicity and physicality. And in a way, if you don't allow the possibility of that, you're left with a kind of, you know, Gnosticism. It's really, you're going back to the second century. And Hick is, in a way, a great modern Gnostic figure who, in the aims of universality, wants to keep the world free from incarnation because it would involve him in the delimitation of spirit. But actually, it's a more magnificent work of transcendent spirit that spirit takes on flesh and reveals himself to us in our normal animal condition. That's a polemical response. Then I would go, you know, I would say the absence of incarnation is not inclusivity of religious traditions, it's indifference to them. So that when you have the increased disinterest in the incarnation, you have the decreased interest in the religious traditions. And when you have increased interest in the incarnation, you have increased engagement with the religious traditions. I mean, who are the people who wrote 25 books about Navajo religion? They were Franciscan missionaries. The guys who studied this stuff were the people who spent their lives evangelizing these people, but they also did it dialogically by getting to know them. I mean, you could talk to, I heard Robert Bello, who was an expert at Harvard on Navajo religion, said he learned, you know, all the fundamental learning began with the Franciscan missionaries. If you look at Evans Pritchard's study of the tribe out, the Nuer tribe, and Nuer theology, so he's an Oxford anthropologist who converted Catholicism while studying tribal ancestral religions in Eastern Africa, the Nuer tribe. But he learned a lot about the Nuer tribe from the White Fathers, you know, the missionary group that was out there, because they were detailing the Nuer theology. So, right, an interest in a particular theological tradition isn't dialectically opposed to profound interest in the particularism of the tradition. In fact, in a certain way, and this is Paul Griffiths, who's a theologian at Duke, makes this point against John Hick, I think, very helpfully, that asking everyone to acquire, as it were, a neutral stance vis-a-vis any particular religious engagement or tradition means that you're really asking everyone who's a religious practitioner to give up their religious tradition as a condition for being religious. But that's not what we do. We practice religions, and we need to learn to engage with other religionists who are deeply ensconced in their religious tradition, as we are deeply ensconced in ours, in perspectives that allow real, honest friendship and acknowledgement of points of dialectical tension or opposition. There's real opposition between Islam and Christianity on major points of the Trinity incarnation, but there are also very important points of convergence. So when you do interreligious dialogue theologically, you're always wanting to emphasize both convergence aspects and you might call them relational or dialectical aspects. And in charity, in friendship. And if we can get to that point, then we really have a grounds for a deep search for the truth together, without having to, as it were, a priori, renounce our traditions as a condition for unity, which in fact then won't be a religious unity at all. It'll be a non-religious unity. Yes, sir?
Okay, well, that was just a great talk. So it was an interesting comment
made that this person's all the way down.
By the way, I should just give credit. That's Eleanor Stump, who I've heard say that. And, you know, I meant to say that in the talk, but that's I thought it was a brilliant point. So I'm just giving credit there. I stole that. Yeah, please.
Right, but, I mean, at the same time, I guess the vast majority of biological life is either non-personal or
right. Personal.
So what would you say to the ecological critique of all that?
Yeah.
Christianity as a whole, Atonement in particular, is
anthropocentric.
Right. It doesn't have anything to offer in terms of the redemption of the cosmos.
Yeah.
In terms of biological.
Right. So I mean, ecological sensibility would require us to kind of relativize personhood and think about ourselves as a tiny bit of a larger cosmos for which we're responsible. Okay, so two things. First of all, there is a hierarchy of being from a Christian point of view. I mean, the human being does bear the image of God in a different way than other created realities, but they are, in the Augustinian tradition, vestiges of God, and they do bespeak something of the transcendent word of God. So there's a pre-human intelligibility and dignity to creatures that are not human, that human beings are relative to and have to respect. The second point is this. I mean, this, by the way, I think is very nicely done by Pope Francis in the encyclical Laudato Si, I think in the second chapter, is that hierarchy and responsibility are not mutually opposed. So we are hierarchically situated in a way above other elements of the cosmos, but we are inscribed within and are members of all the other classes of beings. So there are physical non-living beings, we're physical beings. There are vegetative non-sensate realities, we are vegetative realities. There are sensate realities that are animals, we are a sensate reality that is an animal. And there are spiritual realities, and we're a spiritual reality. And so having that kind of, it's a hierarchical inclusivity, not a hierarchical exclusivity. And what he emphasizes in the sequel is that it doesn't make us irresponsible towards those creatures, but responsible for them. And in a certain way, if we act against them, we don't just act against their dignity, we act against ourselves. So if you think about the person who, for example, to take an offer, you know, who does something like, for example, fighting a dog, who kills or tortures animals, right? You torture the dog, make it meaner for the dog fight or something. You are dehumanized, you're acting in a dehumanized way toward the extrinsic creation, the creation around you, but you're also dehumanizing the animality in yourself. You're responsible in a way another animal wouldn't be, because you're doing it with a rational decision that's spiritual. But you're also doing something violent to your own animality. And then the last thing I'd say is this. For the Catholic metaphysician, or for the Thomist, and for the Christian generally, we are not the masters. We are hierarchically above the creation, but we are not the masters of it. I mean, we're embedded within a larger cosmos that we depend upon. So we have deep ethical responsibilities to other people, for the future generations. If you go around and pollute the earth, you're harming future generations of human beings. You're maybe trashing the creation that other people need to inhabit. But you're also, you're acting against something that speaks the primordial intelligence and beauty of the Logos. That God has made all these things through his own transcendent wisdom. And there's this beautiful integrity and dignity to the creation that bespeaks something of God that we did not put there, that we are meant to admire and contemplate and treat with dignity. You know, so there's a way in which there's a kind of, what Christians can do on this point that I think you can't do if you're a pantheist or think that God is impersonal, is we can say that you're actually acting against God by acting against his creation. But that doesn't maybe give you much, you know, moral motivation or ecological sensibility, but it is metaphysically true that, like, to be in a right relationship with God also means to treat the creation as something mysteriously made by God.
But what, if any, salvific intent does God have towards?
Okay, so I'll say briefly, the incarnation has a cosmic effect. Right. So you have the physical redemption of the cosmos. The tradition, in the universal tradition, I think, from anyone from Irenaeus to Aquinas to John Paul II to the Laudato Si encyclical, is that there are physical cosmic effects to the resurrection. You can say that's eschatology, like in the end times, right? And that actually already, the Catholic theology implies that the Eucharist is a kind of elevation of physical creation already into the redemptive life of the resurrection. Because in the liturgy and in the Eucharist, the elements of creation are being redeemed There is something cosmic about liturgy. There's a way in which the liturgy brings the cosmos to a kind of fulfillment and dignifies physical reality and is anticipating cosmic redemption. So this is not a newfangled idea. That's a very traditional idea.
Can I just make two very brief comments? One is, so the tradition from Irenaeus through Aquinas, through Pope Francis, and Patriarch Bartholomew first, that tradition understands that the fall is not simply a fall of human beings. So the example I use in class is, because, especially for Brown students, this current generation could, find a cure for cancer, find a cure for AIDS, solve the economy of the world, give every single person a home. It could solve all the problems. And we'd still have mudslides and earthquakes and tsunamis. So the fall was something that set the entire cosmos, not just us, into a tragic condition. And salvation, a word that means life, it's a word that means health, salvation, is the return of life to an entire cosmos, but not just to human beings, in life-giving terms. But the other thing I just wanted to, this is for doing something with this, and I'm not paying attention to that. Yeah, but I'm not paying any attention to it, I'm sorry. There's one thing, I know people who aren't used to looking at these. See this? This is the mandorla of light that's around Christ. See the bands of color? So that's the light that is around, you see that light around Jesus, the icons of Jesus at the transfiguration on the table, and reveals himself as divine to his disciples. They see him. But look at these bands of light. It's brightest on the outside, the farthest you're away from Jesus. The farthest you're away from Christ is where the light is the brightest. And the closer you get to him, the light becomes dark. So that brightness of light that looks like clarity is really when you're furthest away from him. And it attracts, we're attracted by that brightness, brings us in. But the closer you get, you enter into that darkness, which is the mystery of knowledge that we're talking about.
Yes. Absolutely.
It works, doesn't it?
It's beautiful. Oh, I knew Father Ambrose would ask a question.
I have a question about atonement. I have a Jewish friend who asked me once, in an attempt to scandalize me, that he said, well, he said to me that he didn't believe that he needed redemption. Salvation, or
right.
To be saved. He didn't need to be saved,
right.
The way he put that. And if taking that into consideration, and also what you said about the importance of having grace to reveal sin to us, is it possible for, on a natural level, to have an awareness of the need for redemption or salvation? And if it is possible, how might those who are not Christian kind of attempt to fulfill that? And if it isn't possible to have it without grace, how might you approach a non-believer to even begin to point out the need, to become an instrument of grace, to point out the need for salvation?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, first of all, I'll just say, I think Judaism does have a very strong concept of a universal need for salvation. I mean, it's obvious that you could have a particular Jewish person or individual or maybe even local community that has different theological interpretations. And obviously you can have people who are somewhat secularized in the Jewish tradition. But I mean, I think it's fairly important to mainstream traditional Judaism to claim that the discrete, distinct election of the Jewish people is of universal significance for the whole human race. And that the human race does have some kind of need of reconciliation with God and with one another. Now they may, on a standard traditional Jewish criticism is that Catholicism has too grave a sense of human sinfulness and maybe too elevated a sense of human sanctity, and kind of maybe extremes. And that's an interesting objection to explore, to discuss. But I do believe like the idea of universal salvation is inherent to a right traditional Jewish understanding of the covenant. The covenant was instituted for the whole healing of the world, and the law was given to the people eventually to be a light to the whole nations. And there's a redemptive mystery still unfolding to the ongoing existence of the Jewish people. So the paradox of universalism and particularism is very intense in Judaism. But if you're going to hold on to the universalist side, which you have to, if you really believe in the institution of the covenant in the life of the Jewish people, then you have to really hold on to some kind of need for universal redemption. I think it's case-specific with any particular religious tradition. You could have Buddhists who might, you know, take on the language, talk about the language, use the language of salvation when talking to Westerners. That wouldn't necessarily be, of course, a perfect translation of what they would use in their own customs and traditions in their native languages in regional Buddhist traditions. But you can find analogies. So I think when you talk about a really like a grounded, deep religionist in like the Buddhist tradition or the Islamic tradition, there are like great differences and great likenesses. Great differences and some likenesses. When you're talking about a person who is maybe religiously unlettered and potentially indifferent or bemused by traditional Christian claims, the Catholic Church does hold that there's like a kind of prior natural intelligibility to good and evil. That can be across a range of degrees. In other words, you know, there's moral blindness exists in all of us, including, in, of course, a lot of Catholics or all Catholics to some extent. Moral blindness exists in all of us, but it can be very acute in the absence of any real relationship with God. And one of the effects of grace is to make our moral blindness to lessen its effect. But that being said, it's not absolute. I do think that it's dangerous to talk about the redemption as first and foremost a kind of reparation of human sinfulness if by that you then lead people to think that the primary message you want to give people is to start to lead with sin. Lead with sin. I mean, that's exactly what a lot of people think about Christianity in general, but also in particular sometimes evangelicals. And that's a sort of massive distortion. So I do think it's important to lead with beauty, lead with truth, lead with goodness. And so the explanatory power of Christianity, the explanatory, the sort of the spiritual life, the goodness of the spiritual life in the great saints and mystics, the beauty of God and the beauty of the Catholic, the artistic and spiritual traditions, Eastern Christian traditions as well. I think beauty, goodness, and truth are how you lead, and then to put the treatment of questions of redemption from sin in that context. That being said, as a Catholic priest, and you know this well, you do talk to people about some of the deepest sufferings that they have are, you know, acute moral agonies. And I don't actually think that this is something that's, you know, reserved at all to Catholics who've been brainwashed by priests and nuns who made them guilt-ridden. On the contrary, I think that people who are far from the Christian tradition often have a very deep awareness of acute moral regret, suffering, shame, and that they need to be liberated from those things. And so, there's a lot here to offer them in terms of a salve for a wounded conscience. So. Yes, Chad, sorry. Maybe we'll make this the last question.
Okay, so I'm just trying to get a little clear on how exactly the crucifixion how exactly it brings about satisfaction or the atonement. So the story that I'm getting from you is that, you know, humans, we sin, that creates alienation with God to such a great extent that no one individually or collectively can sort of restore that relationship with God. So then God becomes incarnate and He does an act of such value, or Christ does an act of such value to the Father, that has such value to the Father that it can now restore the relationship. It didn't have to happen, but it can restore. So then, the question I'm wondering is, why was it that Christ
suffering on the cross. Why did that? Why was that of great value to the Father?
Yeah.
And the reason is supposed to be that it's because Christ showed such love in doing that. Mm-hmm. But then I'm wondering, why did it show such love? One might, like, the natural answer would be, well, it showed such love because Christ knew that if he went through the suffering, then it would bring about the, then, you know, there would be the reconciliation. But now we have sort of a circularity, and everyone we might wonder, well, why did it bring about? Why is it that it brought about the reconciliation? Then we have to go through the whole story again. Well, it was because of the satisfaction, yeah. And the satisfaction because Christ showed so much love, and why did it show so much love? And then, so we basically need Christ through the crucifixion to be showing love, but in some way that's independent of it bringing about the reconciliation between man and God. And so, you know, one thought I had maybe was, you know, maybe because, and I think you might have touched on this in talk, because people go through such terrible injustices, by Christ going through the crucifixion, he was able to identify with the people who had undergone these terrible things. And so that's why it had such value to the Father, and that's why he was able to show love for doing it. But so I guess the question is just, why exactly did he show love?
So I knew there might be at least one analytic philosopher for a loss for presence, so that's why I put the, I did generate the propositions at the beginning, really. I thought that could happen. That was a great question. Look, there's a lot of ink spilled on this particular, like getting into the details of this account. I would not go first to value, because value implies like a mental intentionality, like, you know, the Father has a certain bar that has to be reached, and then Jesus reaches that bar, and God places a value on it. Scotus kind of goes that direction, and he gives this idea that, in fact, merits of Christ crucified are finite, but God just deems them appropriate, proportionately, to then have mercy on the world. So there's a kind of bar of justice that's set, Christ reaches it. I would put it in much more ontological terms and say that it's not first, so you went to the solidarity thing. I do think it's about the solidarity with us. But even more profoundly, the solidarity with us, it stems from what Christ is in his very being. As the God human who has a plenitude of charity in his human heart. And it's that mystery of what I would back up into the actual incarnation and say, what is the novelty, what's the novum that's come about in the crucifixion? Is that one who is both God and human has made a perfect offering of his life to God in the midst of deep solidarity with us in physical and emotional and spiritual suffering. So the core of it is that something new exists. It's the very being of the act of offering in its perfection. And that is like, you could think of it, I usually say this for the resurrection, it's like the second Big Bang. But you could think about it as like the second Big Bang, as the new creation, even in the crucifixion. You've got like a new, beautiful eclosion or blossoming of the real power of divine and human love. And then that can be communicated. So I would stress that first. Then you could say, well, okay, but what about this about just relationships? I do think it is about just relationships, but there it's not that I would say that God, as it were, is waiting to be placated. It's the opposite, that God sends the initiation of the Son sent into the world, in John's language, is in order for God to restore right relationships. So for Aquinas, justice is primarily about right order in the world. Order not in a kind of arbitrary or official sense, but like a deep sense of the well-being. And Christ restores a deep ontological order. So I would think about relationships not in terms primarily of God, like having a mental intention, like, okay, someone's got to make up for what's happened. But primarily in the sense of God's like saying, okay, I want to restore order in the sense of turning the human race back toward me, and I'm going to do it this way and through this event. That's the beginning of an answer. A lot of debate about this issue. Fascinating debate about this issue. And actually, I mentioned Eleanor Stump. She's writing a giant book on, she's finishing a giant book, by the way. On its own theory, where she's going into this, and you know, there's all like a lot of people writing on it. So, and in the analyst philosophy field. Thank you so much for all your attention. You all have been wonderful.